Marion?
Hi, Carl. Good to hear you.
Yes, and good to hear you.
Yeah.
As an American, I would say Marion Jansen. What would you say?
I would say Marianne Jansen, but you can say Marion Jansen. That's fine with me.
Okay. All right. Since you're writing about American subjects, maybe you could introduce yourself and tell us what you're working on and why you're working on it.
Well, thank you. Yes. Well, as you know, and as everybody, your listeners, I'm sure, can tell from my accent, I'm not an American, I'm Dutch. And nevertheless, I've chosen to write in English about American poets. But this was not a given because after high school, I was sure I wasn't cut out for college. And I spent a year as an au pair in London. And there in London, I became addicted to British literature. And when I returned to the Netherlands after that year as an au pair, I decided to enroll in college after all and study Commonwealth literature. However, when I found that the youngest of my four brothers, and he was a budding mathematician, that he had read more American authors than I had, I switched to American literature because I wanted to put him in his place. There was a lot of sibling rivalry going on. Then later, my thesis advisor asked me what my plans were after graduating, and I replied that I wanted to travel, kind of a hippie thing. And then he proposed I visit the United States in search of archival materials for a dissertation on the literary magazine, the Kenyon Review. And I should add that at that time in the Netherlands, you got paid, though not much, but you got paid to write your dissertation. You were a kind of faculty member. So I traveled to America to do archival research on the Kenyon Review and started out in Gambier, Ohio, at Kenyon College. After my dissertation was published by Louisiana State University Press, I was offered a postdoc position and decided to write a biography, and just because I love reading them. And I was very much interested in the position of women writers in a culture where women writers were dismissed, and especially those who were married to other writers. And I'm thinking of Jean Stafford, for instance, married to Robert Lowell, Elizabeth Hardwick, married to Robert Lowell, Caroline Gordon, married to Alan Tate, and also Isabella Gardner, married to Alan Tate and cousin to Robert Lowell. And then I chose to do a biography on Gardner, also because I'd read part of her correspondence when doing research for the Kenyon. And I should perhaps say that this is not the Isabella Gardner of the famous Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in
Right.
Boston, the neglected poet, the god Isabella Stewart Gardner's godchild. It took me a very long time to write that Gardner biography. I had that postdoctoral fellowship for writing the Gardner biography, but I complicated my life by falling in love and marrying a colleague in the English department, but his ex-wife also worked in the English department. So
Oh
I decided,
boy.
so I decided to leave, and I became the director of the international office at my university. And I put Gardner on the back burner. But after a year or 5 years or so, I was granted a sabbatical, and in 2010, finally, my biography, not at all what one is used to, The Life and Times of Isabella Gardner, was published. Okay, fast forward finally to Caroline Kaiser. After my sabbatical year to finish that biography, I returned to my work at the International Office until I received a fan mail from one Ashley Bullitt, and she praised my biography and added that she knew all about it because she knew all the people I wrote about. Because her mother was Caroline Kaiser, the subject of this biography. And I thanked her for her mail and I asked her if anyone was writing her mother's biography, but I didn't want to do it myself at that time because I had my own full-time job. But I had become really interested in Kaiser because I had interviewed her for my Gardner biography. And while interviewing Caroline Kaiser for my Gardner biography, I had heard a kind of undertone, perhaps an upper tone, if you can say that, something like, why is this Dutch woman writing a biography about Isabella Gardner and not about me? Because I'm much more important as a poet. She didn't say that out loud, but it was really an undertone. I had more influence in the American literary world. I'm a proto-feminist. I was writing poetry about the position of women before the second wave of feminism. I was really important in that movement. So all these subtle remarks made it clear that I was not writing a biography about the right woman. And I was really rather intimidated by her, even though we were sipping wonderful wine in her beautiful garden in Sonoma. But I thought, oops, this is an interview that is not going well. But then, you know, much later, I received that that fan mail from Ashley Bollett, Caroline Kaiser's daughter. And she soon, after two or three emails, she sent me a check of $11,000. And I'd never even met Ashley Bollett. She had never met me. She had just read my Gardner biography and said I should write her mother's biography and that I needed that money because I should immediately start interviewing her mother's old friends, lovers, colleagues, because they were, as she said, dropping like flies. And I slowly, really, she suckered me in because she sent me all kinds of scintillating tidbits about her mother, connected me to friends and colleagues, and all this while I still had my job in internationalization. But Ashley succeeded, and perhaps I was won over to writing the Caroline Kaiser biography because Caroline Kaiser, after receiving many, many, many letters about one sentence that she'd written in perhaps her most famous poem, Pro Femina, she had a stamp made that said, irony, irony, irony. And so I couldn't resist that, of course.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Carl.
I was gonna just sort of summarize our discussion so far.
Yeah.
Because it just really fascinates and intrigues me and will be, I think it has been very illuminating for our listeners to know about a hippie biographer with sibling rivalry, who falls in love, who does biography by accident, and who is an opportunist.
Perhaps, yes, that is exactly what I am. But I should say...
I'm not isolating or just picking on you. I think to some extent, you as a biographer, you have to be an opportunist. That is, you're looking for stories that either haven't been told about people's lives or stories that you don't think have been told correctly.
Yeah. And for me also, I think it's serendipity. I also think that serendipity only happens, perhaps like a detective's intuition, if you already know a lot and if you become interested and if you can make, let's say, intuitive links, for instance. And things happen, like indeed Ashley Bollett writing me that letter, or me feeling that Caroline Kaiser was not all that happy that I was writing about Isabella Gardner and not about her. And I think you can only have an understanding of that if you already, let's say, more or less live in the world that you want to write about. I'm a biographer in my heart, I should say. So I wrote about the Kenyon Review, but after that, I thought, I'm not going to write another book about a literary magazine. I could do that. And many books about literary magazines should be written because they are very important in what happened in literature and criticism in the United States. But, you know, I thought, no, that's I don't want to do that. I'm much more intrigued by lives and what they can tell about history.
I was just going to say, I was going to make one other point before we get to Kaiser specifically, which is that we have a history. I reviewed your Isabella Gardner biography.
I know. And thank you for that, because it was a very positive review.
I'm just going to read one sentence. Based on extensive archival research and on interviews with Gardner's contemporaries, this exemplary biography provides fresh insight into recent American literary history.
Thank you. Thank you, Carl. Yes, I was more than pleased by that. I'm really very grateful for that. Thank you.
So after all these years, that was quite some time ago, I wrote that. I had, you know, no one did podcasts when I wrote that review. And I never thought that we would be online talking about your biography of Carolyn Kaiser. So,
We also met once. Do you remember?
No, I have a terrible memory.
Okay. You're a biographer. You don't have a terrible
memory. I know. Isn't that something to admit? Yeah.
we met in Groningen in the Netherlands. You were there for the international biographers meeting, but there were, I guess, about 100 people whom you'd never met, and I was one of the 100. But I, of course, knew who you were. So, yeah, we met.
If I thought hard enough, I probably would remember. Yeah. But it really is true. I have a terrible memory. I have to write things down.
Well, I think every biographer does, because I always do. Yeah. Yeah.
So at what point are you now in this biography of Carolyn Kaiser?
Well, actually, I've finished, if you can say finished, when it's still a manuscript. But I've finished the manuscript, but I'm also more or less in limbo, because I have a very nice American agent, and he seems to think that trade publishers should be interested or would be interested in Carolyn Kaiser's life, because she was important in the literary scene, but also because she had such a flamboyant life. So it's a wonderful story to tell. But he's had it for a few months now, and it's still in his hands, and he's still and he's submitting it to publishers. But I've asked him not to send me any news until he has good news for me, because I guess I would get too depressed by rejections all the time. So I don't know. I send him an email once every month or so, asking him how he's doing and how the manuscript is doing. But it's not easy to have to wait until a book is getting published.
I do look at the rejections. My agent does send them to me when they actually put them in writing. And all I can say is they make me mad.
Oh, they make you mad. Oh, yeah. Well,
they don't depress me. They don't depress me. I'm the kind of person who says, well, that's their loss.
Yeah. No, I'm suffering, I guess, from something like imposter syndrome, because I'm, of course, Dutch. And then I think, well, who am I, you know, Dutch, writing about American poets, writing in English? Why do I think I can do that? And they're right to reject me. So that's my reaction. I wish I could be like you, Carl. I wish I could be like you. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I do. I have one daughter, and I remember when she was quite young, she did very well in school, but one teacher gave her a C on something, and, you know, her reaction was, what's wrong with that teacher?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, you taught your children well, Carl. That's clear.
I don't know. It's something, I guess, in the genes or whatever, that particular view of things. So let's talk more specifically. I know I asked you about perhaps reading a poem of Carolyn Kaiser's. Maybe you want to do that. Maybe you want to introduce it. What's the best way to do this?
Yeah, well, let's just talk about, let me read one of Carolyn Kaiser's poems, because not many people still know her, while she was a wonderful poet. And I would say that, of course, but I really think so. And this is a poem, it's called Thrall, and it's about her father. And Carolyn had a kind of love-hate relationship with her father. And the poem begins when she is young and ends when he's old. And in the first stanza, he reads, and in the last, she reads to him. So it's the love-hate relationship she has with her father. And I'll say a little bit more about it later on, but I'll be reading it now in my best American accent. Thrall. The room is sparsely furnished, a chair, a table, and a father. He sits in a chair by the window. There are books on the table. The time is always just past lunch. You tiptoe past as he eats his apple and reads. He looks up, angry. He has heard your asthmatic breathing. He will read for years without looking up until your childhood is safely over. Smells, untidiness, and boring questions, blood from the first skinned knees to the first stained thighs, the foolish tears of adolescent love. One day, he looks up, pleased at the finished product. Now he's ready to love you. So he coaxes you in the voice reserved for reading Keats. You agree to everything. Drilled in silence and duty, you will give him no cause for reproach. He will boast of you to strangers. When the afternoon is older, shadows in a small room fall on the bed, the books, the father. You read aloud to him, La Belle Dame sans merci. You feed him his medicine. You tell him you love him. You wait for his eyes to close at last so you may write this poem. That's the end of the poem. And the end of Ben Fraser's life. Yeah. Pardon?
Carl? Yeah. It's a marvelous poem. I'm sure, at least for some of our listeners, it will deal with experiences that they've had. The father that's described in this poem is rather like my father. It resonates. The only difference is I don't know what he would have been like as he grew older, because he died at 51. I was only 13. But the father sitting at the table, inaccessible to the child, the image that really, wow, it just resonates. You know, I don't know if you've looked at it, but I couldn't resist. I looked at the Wikipedia entry on Carolyn Kaiser. And one of the first things it mentions is this ambivalent feeling about her father.
And clearly here she isn't, I think, as her biographer, she's not fair to him at all. But when are poets ever fair, I should say, perhaps, because especially when one sees Benjamin Kaiser as a father in the context of his times. And Carolyn Kaiser was born in 1923, not 1925, as the Wikipedia says. So he was a father in the 1920s and 1930s. And at that time, he was much more involved with his daughter than most fathers. And I've read really loving and lovely letters by him when he was away for work. And he was, in general, much more involved. But on the other hand, he was also very strict and a disciplinarian. And he had, well, enormous expectations of her. So as the poem says, he will boast of you to strangers, because Carolyn was a very intelligent woman and precocious and a wonder child, if it were. And so she always felt that pressure from him that she should behave and be wonderful and, be what he hoped she would be, a great poet, for instance. Yeah.
Yes. The last two lines of the poem are almost blood-curdling in a way, and say so much about what writers are and what writers do. She says, "You wait for his eyes to close at last, so you may write this poem."
Yeah.
It gives me chills.
Yeah. And it also shows that she does love him, because otherwise she would have written this poem before he died. He suffered from dementia. He lived into his late 80s, but suffered from dementia for the last 10 years of his life. And this poem is also, and he was always very voluble and intelligent and long letters and talked all the time. But for the last 5 or 6 years of his life, he refused to talk, perhaps like Ezra Pound, who also refused to talk at the end. And Carolyn actually also suffered from dementia during the last 10 years of his life. And she also decided to stop talking, because I think that when she no longer could express herself the way she wanted to express herself and was used to express herself, she stopped talking, like her father.
That's fascinating. Yeah. That's a really interesting.
Yeah, tragic. Yeah.
But I can see how this biography is just going to be tremendous.
I certainly hope so. When a publisher picks it up, I should say. Yeah.
Yeah. You sent me some lines that she wrote about biographers. Can you read that?
Certainly. It's part of a very, very long poem, because Carolyn, it was difficult to choose poems by her to read for this podcast, because she was wont to write long narrative poems. So this is part of a long poem called Fin de siècle blues, which she wrote just before the before 2000. And the part that I'm going to read is about poets or writers and biographers. And she starts with describing the poets. "Oh, you serious men and women who wrote your poems, met your classes, counseled your students, kept your friends, and sent magic letters home. Your lives are pillaged and are rearranged by avid biographers who boast that they tell all. So it seems you always reeled in a mad whirl of alcohol, abandonment, and sexual betrayal. I sorrow for the stain on your memory, Anne, Randall, Ted, Elizabeth, Delmore, John, and Cal. As writers, what are we to do? Our roles as witnesses ignored, our fine antennae blunted by horror piled on horror, our private matters open to the scrutiny of voyeurs. If we have wit and learning, it's met with the apathy of the ever more ignorant young. How do we hope to carry on in the last gasp of the millennium?" And then she answers herself. "Much as we always have, writing for one another, for the friends we tried to impress in school." And then a little later on, she, with typical self-irony, she shows that poets, in fact, are not much better than the biographers she has just maligned. And she says, "But first of all, we'll do it," writing, she means, "for ourselves, selfish and narcissistic and obsessed as ever, invading the privacy of those who care for us, spilling sad secrets confided by a lover." And I'll be spilling Carolyn's secrets, of course, by her many lovers.
We all do, actually, as novelists, poets, writers, and biographers. The thing is, as this poem suggests, there aren't really very many creative writers who think a biography as creative, number one, and number two, who think of biographers as part of their literary world. that'll separate, you know, biographers is somehow doing, even though biographers, for instance, they say, oh, biographers tell all. Are you kidding? Given the laws of libel and copyright, especially in certain countries, it's very difficult for a biographer to just make things up the way someone could in a novel. I think it's very difficult. But Kaiser obviously shows a great deal of self-awareness here, both about her attitudes and her fellow writers as well as biographers. When you first hear these lines, especially at the beginning, you think, ah, this is the Janet Malcolm view of biography.
Right. Yeah. Somewhere else she says, I hope I've burned enough of my love letters, but she hasn't, not at all. And she, I think, perhaps secretly hoped that someone would write her biography, because when you write a biography, you're also positioning a writer in more or less, or at any rate, you try to put her in the canon to make her known, to make her work better known. And that's, of course, what she wanted. And when she sold her papers to the Lilly Library at Indiana University in Bloomington for lots and lots and lots of money, I should say, she left almost everything in. So I've read letters by, for instance, love letters by Abe Fortas, the Supreme Court justice whom she had a long affair with. But also, for instance, a poem that she never published about a one night stand she had with Hubert Humphrey, also an LBJ's vice president. So it was a wonderful collection to read. And Carolyn had many, many, many lovers, many of them literary. And
I can see where your agent wants a trade publisher.
I hope he succeeds, but if not, I'll be happy with an academic publisher also. I was happy with Louisiana State Press that published my Kenyan.
Yeah. That's a good press. I reviewed some of their books. There's this line, Kaiser's line that you read about writers, what we do to ourselves, invading the privacy of those who care for us. It reminds me of something that the Polish poet Czesław Miłosz once said. He said, once a writer is born in the family is lost.
Carolyn, you quote that, and Carolyn quotes it also somewhere, because she also knows what she is doing. And she also, she quoted Miłosz also. Yeah. And it's also interesting because she says here, invading the privacy of those who care for us, which is exactly also what she did when she was writing that poem about her father, Thrall, that I read. But of course, this is after he died.
So what else should I have asked you?
Or that you want to say
that I didn't allow you to say?
You allowed me to say everything I wanted to say. Perhaps I should say, and that's perhaps the trade publisher thing, that and it's also about me, because Carolyn lived a very interesting life, and I really like to, you called me opportunistic, which is perhaps what I am, but I love to write about wild women poets who burn the candle at both ends. And perhaps this is because all of us biographers, but I also think readers of biographies are voyeurs, and we're interested in the lives of others. And Carolyn said at a certain point in the early 1960s, and she wrote to her friend lover Hayden Cruz, that she wishes, and I'm quoting here, "My goddamned life would quit trying to resemble a rather large, lousy novel." And that's what interested me, because I think I cannot write. My imagination is not, wild enough to imagine a life as as wild as Carolyn. So I need the narrative of a life to be able to write, actually. I don't think I could write fiction.
So is the title of your book Carolyn Kaiser, Wild Woman Poet?
No, the title is Narcissist by Necessity, the Flamboyant Life of Carolyn Kaiser.
And well, that's pretty good.
Yeah, Narcissist by Necessity, because she says, self-knowledge, in one of her poems, her most famous poem, Pro Femina, she says that women writers with children have to be narcissists by necessity. And she was, in a way. Yeah.
Well, I have to say, trade book publishers, if you're not listening, it's your loss.
Well, thank you, Carl. I mean, yeah. Okay.
Soon to be a major motion picture.
Okay, and I think, Carl, we should stop now, but thank you very much for these wonderful words. It's lovely talking to you, and I'll continue listening to your great podcast, and I learn everything.
Great, thank you, and I will post this shortly so you can have the link.
Thank you, Carl. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.